Lovely to be here today. Feeling the great spiritual presence deep in you. And letting that presence radiate through your body. Feeling that light, that love, that divine joy radiating from your heart. And going out to every cell of your body. It transcends all other realms of experience, beyond body, beyond mind, beyond feeling. It is your eternal source. Sense there that you lived long before you came into this body. One day this body will dissolve back into dust, and you will exist long after this body. That from this perspective, this point of view, life is just but a passing play, a lila of the Lord's. That you are the eternal self, untouched, unstained by any earthly experience. It is purity itself, light, love, joy. And you are that. You are that. Now join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. Nothing I'd rather do than be here with you. God has had me in quite a state lately. So, for my posting, only today got out the July 4th. It was written before, but not completed. And hope it's not confusing. I put in a Christmas card with the lion and the lamb as a picture. But I love that picture. I love the picture of the lion. And it's a little bit of snow. You can imagine maybe it's sand instead of snow. A revolution occurred in 1776. Not simply a revolution of man against man, but a revolution of thoughts and of spirit. It was an idea that had been evolved thousands of years before, but had been forgotten or ignored. We were gradually coming out of the Dark Ages, where superstition was prevalent and despots, even occasionally somewhat benevolent ones, ruled the world. The newly evolving idea was a republic, a constitutional democracy that had a balance of power built in, and a Bill of Rights to protect the individual from the overreach of government. These were radical, revolutionary ideas that had never been tried before in the remembered past, and most in the world at the time thought it impractical. This idea of a constitutional democracy with protection from mob rule has now spread across this world India being the largest democracy, and brought about by a nonviolent revolution. Although violence quickly ensued after their emancipation, it has been tough to escape the Dark Ages. Democracies, by their very nature, are noisome, messy. Short-term efficiency comes from a dictatorship, but that comes with self-destructive results repeatedly proved over these many centuries. The result of this experiment in democracy has resulted in a country with many personal freedoms, prosperity, and an ability to adapt and change. It is a sad irony that some of the very ones who originally fought for their own freedom justified enslaving others. With a costly civil war, that injustice was reversed, and while having equal rights for all citizens has taken time and the sacrifice by many, still this form of government has shown the flexibility to adapt and change. The key to any society surviving and thriving is for the vast majority of people to abide by the eternal truths that all religions have taught. The central commandments of Moses, the yamas and niyamas of Patanjali, are best summed up by Jesus in Matthew 22. Verse 37, Jesus said unto them, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart, with all of thy soul, and with all of thy mind. This is the first and the great commandment. And the second is like unto it, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Upon this principle of love for God and for those around you hang all the laws and teachings of the prophets. This is so very true. We try to make up for the lack of observance of this most basic principle by writing more and more laws, wanting social justice, but often end up straining at gnats while swallowing camels, with the result that laws upon laws oftentimes do little to help us and instead turn into burdens for the majority. If we want justice, then we must treat others justly. If we want respect, then we must begin by giving it. With every word and action we create, then we reap what we have set into motion. As Mother said, this world is made up of individuals, and as the individuals change, so does the world. We should not look to some grand scheme of a Savior from above, but to the universal Savior within. All the laws and all the prophets hang upon what are ultimately deeply held spiritual principles, and when a significant number of individuals act accordingly, this world will be a haven of peace where the lion lies down with the lamb in total harmony. And then I had an additional health update. After the positive results of various scans by my allopathic doctor, I consulted with my new oncological naturopath. Dr. A, the naturopath, seeks to create a healthy bioenvironment that will produce perfect health in which such things as cancer cannot thrive. A primary diagnostic tool is taking specific blood tests to indicate imbalances in such categories as zinc and copper, vitamin D, some 50 different measurements. These were all taken before my second visit to the doctor. In all tested categories, I was in the desired range, and a few deserved a surprised, excellent comment. He has subtracted a couple of supplements from my previous naturopath had prescribed. He had studied with Dr. R, so they are on the same page in most things. And he added a few things, such as green tea extract, filled with polyphenol antioxidants and reduces inflammation. Some of our goals are to reduce inflammation and oxidation. He was pleased with my weight loss and approved following my current food regimen. Onward with continued perfect health, he has extended the time that I see him to 1 year from now. Meanwhile, I continue with my current supplements. So I know many of you are interested in that, so I include those health updates as well. a wonderful thing, getting this body into better and better condition so that perfect health should be not just mine, but that we should all enjoy it. It's not the final arbiter in our happiness, for indeed we can rise above the things of this body. But when the body is ill, when it has pain, when there are difficulties, it makes it very challenging. And one thing, because God is things that are not connected with my health, but things that God puts me through, his body has been in a lot of pain recently. And it's an interesting time to think about and to work with this relationship that I have with this body. And so, in thinking about pain, it can so dominate the brain. And how do we remember God when we have pain? And you think about that God is everything. And as Papa says, God comes as pain and bliss both. And that he even goes so far as to say that pain is bliss. And that during his sadhana days, his mind was so fixed upon God, and he was feeling such bliss in God, that even though his body could be in great pain at the time, he had cuts on his feet and was continued walking on sharp rocks and other difficulties that he had as he went through this intense period. And that the same nerves that carry the pain impulses to the brain can also carry bliss. But when you think of the pain and you think, all right, God, you have come to me in this form at this moment. And so it changes your relationship. So much of our mind and our body resists the pain. It tightens up around it. It contracts, and it can also produce fear. How long will this pain last? How long can I live with this? I remember when going to Vancouver, and there was a woman there who had wanted to come to service for quite some time, but it seemed like every time I came, she was going through cancer treatments. And the cancer treatments had not been successful, and she was in the last few weeks of her life, and word came to me that she would like to see me, and so of course I went to the hospital to see her. And she was all swollen up in her body due to the chemo treatment she is getting. Her skin was off color. She had not a stitch of hair, no eyebrows, no hair, nothing. And so I took her hand and we talked for quite some time, and she had some forgiveness to do. She had done some things herself that she felt like she needed forgiveness from God from, and then she had some things that she needed to let go of in relationship to her son primarily. And so we worked on forgiveness and on the letting go, and then she felt extremely relieved. She felt that that was a burden that was taken off of her. And so we talked some about her physical condition. I asked her how she was doing given the circumstances, and she said she was doing all right. But she was afraid in the next few weeks that they had given her to live, how bad the pain would get and whether she would be able to take it or not. And so it's interesting, in the moment she was all right, but she was worried about how bad things were getting. And I thought and reflected, if most people thought of themselves being in her position, she's in a hospital bed, her body is all swollen up, her skin was turned a type of a green, and she didn't have any hair on her, and she'd been through all this cancer and cancer treatments. Most people would think that was hell, and they would be afraid to be in her position. But she wasn't afraid at all. She was all right. But she was worried about how far it would get, how far God would take her into that pain. And so I talked to her about what God had given me one time, that grace is there to more than sufficiently help you when you are going through anything that he gives you. And that the reason we sometimes look forward in the future and we wonder whether we will be able to take something or not is because we're not there yet. And so we're not conscious of the grace that's flowing to us that will sustain us at that time, at that future time. So we think back in our lives and we think sometimes, how did I do what I did? I was taken through so many difficult, painful journeys in this lifetime. And how did I exist? And it's because God's grace is there. And for people who don't have any access to that grace, because of their doubt or their fear or for whatever reason, they can feel that it's shut out. But the truth is, they're shutting it out themselves. If they can open themselves to it, many people get very angry with God because of the circumstances that they find themselves in. And that anger keeps God's grace out. Or it can be fear, just exactly as this woman was experiencing. How bad will it get? Will I be able to take it? How long can I take it for? And so in that thought, we add the ingredient, and particularly from behind you, all along your spine, you see that river of life flowing into you, that comforter that is sent to you. And you soften and open all along your spine. And you feel that grace flowing into you. You feel it flowing into you in this moment. If there's any future anticipation of any time that you have a greater need, you see it flowing to yourself fully and completely. You can see it flowing to somebody else who's going through an extreme circumstance. It's your prayer for them, that they should feel that great comforter coming in, that it should comfort them not only physically, but emotionally and mentally as well, that aligns them with true spirit. And as you see that for yourself and for others, you know that you will always be sustained, that there will never be a time that you are abandoned. This is deep down our greatest fear, that we will be alone, that we will have no comforter with us. And oftentimes we think of having other people around us or that kind of comfort, that kind of help when we're feeling alone. But there's a far greater friend that we have access to. And to soften and open all along your spine, to feel that great river of life, that great Om, Amen, flowing into you. That even the pain that comes to you is God coming to you in that form. And when you make that connection, it somehow changes the pain. Pain may still be there, but the Comforter is also there. And it changes our relationship to it. And it's no longer about the future, but it's what's right here and now. And right here and now, it's all right. It's all right. I've heard from many people about how wonderful they think the latest Cross and Lotus Journal is. And I agree, I think it is wonderful. I'd like to read from Mother's The Inner Kingdom. The inner kingdom that we have is such a tremendous, marvelous, mystical thing of God's creation that it is difficult for us to comprehend in the worldly consciousness with our worldly mind. But yet, we have the kingdom of heaven within us and the kingdom of earth. It is up to us whether we want to live in this kingdom of heaven or solely in the kingdom of earth. We can make this earth a heaven, or we can make it a hell. And that, too, is within us, and the choice is ours. This body is so wonderful when you stop and think about it. It is an exact replica of everything in the outer universe. We have the sun, which is the spiritual eye in the center of the forehead. We have the moon, which is the second brain, the solar plexus. We get feelings of intuition there, which, when we are tuned in with the Spirit, gives us information which is absolutely true. We have the rivers, which are the circulatory system. We have an elimination system. We have a system which breathes and provides oxygen, which keeps the life in our body. Above all, we have a heart. And all of that which is within us is tied in this one place within us, which is the seat of all life. When we are about to put our feet on the spiritual ladder, we go through many, many stages. In the beginning, perhaps, we don't even believe in God. We don't believe in a superior power, a superior intelligence. But gradually, through the experiences of life, which are very difficult, we are forced to turn our attention, our faces, towards the higher power, to acknowledge that there is such a thing to reach out, perhaps crying in our need, "Father, help me, help me." Even the most hardened criminal, when he is faced with something terrible, perhaps as a result of the sins that he has committed, finally reaches out to God and says, "God, help me. God, save me." And then the soul awakens to the fact that there is a superior power. We go through the various stages of belief in the Orthodox teachings, of which there are many and varied. But at last, there is a reaching out from the darkness for something that is greater, and it is an urge to know the mystery of life, to know about the riddle of life. This inner urge is this exactly: man, know thyself. Do you really know yourself, the real self? Or are you acquainted with just the outer person, the one who has been taught reading, writing, arithmetic, the various arts, the sciences, and the superficial things of life? Or do you know your real self, which is God within you? You put your feet upon this path, and you stand, and you start your upward journey. You don't know where it's going to take you. So you have to lay hold of the great thing, and that is called faith. Faith in God, faith in His power to provide all that is necessary for you, to protect you through all the experiences which you, as an individual soul, are going to go through. We are all on this path, but for one purpose, and that is to realize our oneness with our Father. It is said that the kingdom of God and the kingdom of heaven are both within. If we find God first, then all the other things are added unto us. This is true. Whatever clothes we need, whatever food we need, whatever money we need, whatever we need in service is given to us when we give ourselves completely and absolutely to God. And I can absolutely verify what Mother says here. There have been times when God has taken everything from me in a material sense, even position in society, everything that we think of as our own. And I was surprised sometimes because I didn't think I was particularly attached to any of these things. But it's a little bit like if you are out in a sailboat or you are trying to navigate in some way. And you look to the stars and you look to different things around you to triangulate yourself, to know where you're at and where you're headed for. And so you have a home and you have a body, you have clothing, you have perhaps a profession. All of these different things help to identify, this is me, this is who I am in this world. And one by one, God took every one of those things away from me, so that there is nothing to sound out, there is nothing to reflect back and say, this is who I am in this world, this is my position, this is my name, this is anything at all that identifies me. And having it all taken away, I had only one place to go, and that was to God, in order to know who I really was. So there was purpose behind why everything was taken away. And yet He sustained me. He kept me alive. I remember one time I was walking up a hill when I was living at Peters in Kirkland. And as I was coming up the hill, suddenly all my life force left me, just enough to sustain a heartbeat and mindful awareness, but I couldn't move any part of my body. And I felt like I could just drop the body right there and leave it, and never look back again. And I knew that I was absolutely dependent upon God. If I were to take another step, but there is nothing inside of me that particularly wanted to take another step, I was very willing to drop the body right then and just merge and be one with God. So I had a little conversation with God, and I said, "All right, if you're ready, I'm ready. And you can take this body now. And you can take me wherever you will. And if you want me to continue in this body, then you must supply the life energy." And it seems like a simple thing, you know. We take it so for granted to be able to get up and to walk across a room. But what allows us to be able to do that? What allows us to even have the idea to be able to do it? And that is God that is constantly flowing to us. You know, in the Holy Science, some creative editor went back through Sri Yukteswar's writing. He wrote it in English when he wrote it originally in French, and then a priest lost it, he said, his only copy, and so he rewrote it, and he wrote it all out in English. So some creative editor changed what Sri Yukteswar had written, and he said, "God creates this world." And the creative editor had gone through and said, "God created this world," because that's what we're used to, isn't it, in the Old Testament. But it's a significant change, because God creates, He actively sustains this world moment to moment. As Krishna says in the Gita, "You can perhaps not think of me, but if I were to not think of you," speaking as the supreme being and intelligence of this entire universe, "if I were to not think of you even for a moment, you would disappear. You would no longer be there, because I sustain you." Now God creates, He sustains, and then He withdraws it all back into Himself once again. Mother told that wonderful story of the Om, the A-U-M. And each one stands for an aspect of creation. So in India, they have the creator, the preserver, and the destroyer. And so God breathed out the A and said, "Ah." And as He did so, all creation came into being. And then He saw that it was good, and He wanted to preserve it. And so He breathed out the word "you," and He said, "Ooh." And He preserved what He had created. And at some point, He decided and wanted to withdraw it all back into Himself once again. And so He said the word "M," or the letter "M." And He said, "Mmm." And He withdrew the whole universe back into Himself. Now, this is happening on a microcosm as well as in the macrocosm. And so it happens individually, too. At some point in your evolution, God has brought you out into being. And He sustains you in this world. And when it is His sweet will, He withdraws you back into Himself once again. And so you get the urge inside of you. You think it is your own idea many times. Oh, I want to pursue this spiritual path, without realizing God is thinking those thoughts through you. He's expressing His will. It's time for you to come home, my child. And so He starts these thoughts in your mind. And then He leads you into a spiritual path, and He gives you a spiritual sadhana. Now, we have been so greatly blessed because we have been given the very finest tools in order to realize God. We have been given Kriya Yoga. We have been given chanting Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. You can't do Kriya Yoga 24 hours a day. But you can chant God's name anytime, any place. We have been given Hong Sa. And so these things are tremendous. They really are. And on the surface, they can seem a little bit simple. You know, not complicated, but there's a design in that. Babaji so perfectly designed the Kriya Yoga. It is the cool and the warm. It is the up and the down. It is the in and the out. It's all the opposites that are brought into perfect balance inside of us. And as we practice this, we are brought into the still state. It's not the practice itself that is the end product. The practice itself brings us into a state of stillness, and that we must practice. You can call it the after effect of Kriya. And so you do your Kriya, and then you come into that stillness, into that still state, and you reside in that stillness. And as the image that God gave me one time, it's like it's a perfectly still lake. And that the body and worldly consciousness is like this tremendous waterfall that is one end of the lake. And so you have all of this potential energy in the lake, but it is absolutely still when there's no wind and there's nothing going on. It's deep, it's quiet, it's perfectly placid. And then you go to the end of the lake, and then you see where it turns into this waterfall. And it is so powerful, it's so dynamic, it's so loud. And you realize all of that energy, all of that power was contained in the potential energy before it was turned into the kinetic energy of the waterfall. And how tremendous that is. And that we are oftentimes very taken up with all of the kinetic energy of life, the rajasic nature of it. And the mind is always going, and we're always pulled into this world. To create the balance, to remember who and what we truly are, we go back into that stillness. But it's not such an easy thing to do. We become so habituated to this kinetic, rajasic energy. We're addicted to it, really. And you see that. I remember walking in when I was in high school, and my mother was in the kitchen, and in the living room, the TV was playing. And so I thought, well, there's nobody in here watching it. I'll just turn it off. And I turned it off, and my mother said, well, why did you do that? And I said, well, nobody's in here watching it. Well, I like hearing it while I'm in here. So turn it back on, please. And so it's just this constant need. You see that with people, and certainly I had it myself at the time. My mother claimed that my car wouldn't run without the radio, because it was always blaring any time that the car was on. And we get used to it, and then it gets difficult to learn how to be quiet. You get into a little stillness, you get without all of these different electronics that are beeping and shining at you and all the different things they do, and your mind gets restless. Oh, I wonder what's on television. I wonder what my latest email is. I wonder what the text is that I got, and so on. And the mind wants to go back to it and create it, even though it's not necessary in the moment. So we have to learn to train the mind to get habituated towards the silence, towards the quiet. And it can be a difficult thing at first, like I say, because we're so addicted to the things of this world. And even if we don't have any outward noise going, the mind will start to create. It'll start to imagine. It'll bring up things from the past. It'll bring up things from the future. It'll do anything to create stimulation. I remember when I first went in to Cloud Mountain in my year of silence and solitude. And I had been traveling and giving talks and meeting with people, and I'd been quite active beforehand. And I knew that there would be a transitional time, that it would take some time for the things to begin to quiet down. And it did. It took some weeks as it gradually allowed it to get quieter and quieter and quieter. Now, a real master, perhaps, just be able to stop it right now. But I wasn't there yet. And so it took a little while for it to all quiet down. And silence is so much more than just not speaking. That's really not silence at all. As Mother said, real silence is when your eyelids don't move. It's when you don't have a thought, when you have come into that stillness of the great lake that's behind the waterfall, and you feel yourself complete in yourself. There is no place to go. There is nothing to do. And I remember, as I was going through that transitional period, just being aware that I had no place to go to. I wasn't going to get up and go to the store to do any shopping or anything, just little things like that that we're so used to in this lifetime. And it was all taken away. It was all gone. It was voluntary, but it was all gone. And this is a requirement at times during our spiritual practice. Now, we lead busy lives, most of us. And yet, we come to that point where we have to set aside the things of this world. We have to be willing to go deeper into God consciousness. Master would say that when he sat down to meditate, he vowed never to get up until he had made actual God contact during that meditation. Now, some of us have to get up and go to work and do other things, and so it's not always possible to do that. But do we take the time at some point where we are willing to dive deeper? Can we make arrangements where we can have that hour, that 2 hours, that 3 hours, however long it takes? There's just something about time and meditation that's required to go deeper. And I've likened it to going down through different thermal layers in the ocean. And you go down to a certain thermal layer, and it's almost as if it's a hard surface. And it starts to repel you. It's difficult to get through that next layer. And it's like that in our consciousness. We get to some place, and we'll get into a deep state of meditation, and suddenly we'll just pop right back up to the surface. And it can be a radical change at times. And you think to yourself, what just happened? And if you can slow it down, you'll realize that some thought came to you, and you had an attachment to that thought. And that thought brought you right back up to the surface. So you get right busy again. And you go to quiet the mind again. And you feel that divine presence, and it takes you down deeper and deeper. And you'll get to that same resistant spot. And it may take you some time. But eventually you break through that barrier. And you go to the next level of inner quietude. And so it's quite a journey that we go through. It's quite a journey. And yet it's all returning back to our very selves. We're not really going anywhere. We talk about a journey because that's a familiar kind of a roadmap we have in our mind. But you need not go anywhere. In fact, it's entirely beneficial to stay exactly where you're at. When the disciples came to Trelyanga, who was thought of so highly in Benares in India at the time, and then Lari Mahashaya came to him, and they pronounced deeply to each other. And Trelyanga said some very kind things and treated Lari Mahashaya in a very special way. And the disciples saw this. They saw also that Lari Mahashaya was just a householder in their thoughts. They were these renunciants, right? They are the ones who lived out by the riverbanks and meditated there. What was this householder? How was it that he was getting this special treatment from this godlike being, Trelyanga? And so they asked him. And he said, Lari Mahashaya is just like a little kitten. He's like God's kitten. God picks him up and he places him down here and he just stays there because that's where God placed him. So you see, you can't tell by the outer conditions of an individual. Somebody can have all the clothing and all the marks of somebody who's a renunciate, and yet they haven't renounced the world at all. They're quite proud of their position. My first time when I was at Anandashram, I was there for 6 months, off and on at first, and then I was there 4 months continuous. And there's a special celebration. and in the special celebration, Swami Satchidananda's 50th sannyas. And so, for some reason, he asked me if I would be in charge of the Westerners. And every time Swami Muktananda would see me, he'd say from a distance, "Oh, there's David, he's in charge of the Westerners," and he'd laugh in an uproarious kind of way. And I wasn't quite sure what the joke was. And then I had to deal with the Westerners, and I found out what the joke. They were so relieved not to have to do it, because they all whined and complained about this and that and the other thing. And so that's the way that it was. But there was some Westerners who were staying in one of the buildings there, and there was some sadhus who came and camped out in their front porch area, and they were singing, chanting, and doing different ceremonies all through the night. And so the Westerners were complaining. So I talked to Swami Satchidananda about it, and he said, "Well, I'll send somebody and talk to them." But I had talked to the Swami initially, and he's very proud. He's very egotistical. He said, this ashram isn't here for you. This ashram is here for us. We're not going to move." And they were supposed to be down by the what they called the sadhu dham. That's where the sadhus would stay at, and they weren't supposed to be up where they were. So they came and they got them, and they asked them to leave. But you could tell so much ego, you could tell so much pride in this individual. He hadn't renounced the world at all, and he was very particular about the way he wore his orange clothes. And so you see that. And you see that this isn't something that where they've renounced. I remember when I first got to India, and I was so disappointed after the first few days of being there in Delhi and then up in Haridwar. And I said, Haridwar is by the banks of the Ganges there. There's a sadhu who is sitting off to the side. And so he beckoned me to come, and I came and I sat, and I thought we might meditate for a while. And he started telling me about this mala that he had, and that he had meditated over it for a long time, and that then he wanted to give it to me as a special gift. And I thought, well, that's nice that he wants to do that. That he demanded 50 rupees. And it's something that you normally in the marketplace, you pay maybe 5 or 10 rupees for it. And I thought, he's nothing but a salesman in orange clothing. And I was so disappointed. And so I went down to the Ganges, and they sell these little candles. These little, and they turn into boats, and they have a candle, and they have some flowers, and you light the candle, and the idea is you put it in the Ganges, and after lighting it, you set it in a float, and it floats down the river, and the saying goes that if the Ganges takes it, you see it taking it down and submerging it, then your prayer is answered. So I prayed, and I said, "Babaji, in the form of the Ganges, hear my prayer. Reveal to me spiritual India." And then I lit the candle and I set it afloat. And it must have worked, because when I got back to the tourist bungalow where I was staying, there was a man there, and he said, "Do you want to see Lari Mahashay's samadhi?" And I said, "Yes, of course I do." And so he knew where it was. And he took me, and it wasn't far away, but you'd never know that it was there. And unbeknownst to me, it was Lari Mahashay's birthday. And so there's a group there from Yogada Satsang who were all meditating up on the top. And I was just so thrilled. And then they took me under their wing, and they just treated me like royalty the whole time that I was there. And then a few days later, it's his Mahasamadhi day, excuse me. And then a few days later was his birthday, and they invited me to a doctor's home where they were celebrating that. And it was just beautiful. And there was a man there who was the gatekeeper at the dam. There's a dam that's right there by Kesha Ashram. That's Swami Keshavananda's ashram there. And he had taken some of Lari Mahashay's ashes, and he had brought them there and built a samadhi temple over these ashes. And he was no longer in the body. But this gatekeeper that was at the dam, he was very humble, had a beautiful feeling about him. And he told me this story is actually translated by another man because he didn't speak English, and they encouraged him to tell me the story. And he said he was sitting in his little gatehouse at the dam there. That's right next to Swami Keshavananda's ashram. And he said that he just felt this powerful spiritual force just hit him and held it in his grip for quite a bit. And then it released him. And he really didn't have any idea of what that was all about. And then suddenly that power hit him again, and he felt compelled to walk out of his gatehouse, walk along the wall of the ashram, and come out to the front. And there was a man with long hair and two women that were with him. And he knew instantly that this was Babaji. And there was a Kumbh Mela going on at the time. So he pranamed at his feet, and then they walked through Keshavananda's ashram. And there's a certain tree there that's a Rudraksha tree. And Rudraksha beads are used by yogis for their malas. They wear them around their necks. And so Babaji, is said, had planted that tree there. Now it's a very large tree, and they will give you a Rudraksha seed when you're there from this tree. And so they walked all around the grounds there. And on the one hand, he is thrilled that Babaji is there. But on another hand, he was a little bit upset with him. And the reason for the upset was because this man had not had enough money for his daughter to get married as a dowry, and yet she was of marriageable age. And so he was very consternated about that, and so he prayed to Babaji at one time that this somehow get resolved. And when he woke up that morning, underneath his pillow was a large wad of rupees, enough to get his daughter married and to have proper ceremony and to feed people afterwards and all the rest of it. And he's so thrilled about this. And when the day came for her marriage, he had wanted Babaji so much to be there. And so Babaji had not shown up for the marriage ceremony, and he's very hurt by this. And he was carrying that around with him. And as they walked around on this day when Babaji did come, they were walking around, and Babaji described in detail everything that happened at his daughter's marriage ceremony. And it healed that hurt. He realized that even though he had not had the eyes to see him, Babaji had been there the whole time. And so they finally came out to the front of the ashram, and there was a car there that was waiting for him. And because of the accents that they spoke with, I thought the man who was translating had said that there was a Model T. And I thought, well, that's very odd, that it's a Model T. And later on, I saw that there's a car in India that's called a Maruti. And I thought, oh, he was saying Maruti. He wasn't saying Model T. And so Babaji and the two, he knew one of the women was Mataji, his sister, but he didn't know about the other. And suddenly Babaji disappeared into the car, and he realized he hadn't pranamed at his feet. And he's feeling almost panicked about that, that he hadn't had that opportunity. So the door opened up, the feet came out, and he pranamed down at his feet. And so he had that opportunity. And there is nothing of but honesty and truthfulness in this man. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience to be able to hear him talk about this in this way. So these things happen. And there are miracles that happen, but the greatest miracle happens right inside of us. Because God's presence, the same God that is the creator of this entire universe and everything in it, that power, that intelligence, that everythingness, that this entire universe is just a small footstool underneath God's feet. As tremendous as it is, as powerful as it is, as big as it is, as the intelligence that goes behind the creation of a seed, or of a tree, or of a planet, or of a vast universe, is just about a small expression, and all of that is contained inside of you. And yet we walk around acting as if it never existed at all, and that we know nothing of it. And what a shame it is. We live a life as a human being, it is true. And we have the anticipations, and we have the joys, and we have the sorrows that are all part of a human life. But there is so much more to us. There is such a vast nature that is waiting for us to discover it. And yet, what do we do about it? Do we really take the time? Do we make the effort to go deeper inside? Or do we just make excuses? Do we just get distracted? And we think, well, there's so many things for me to do. And yet, what is more important than that? If you can think of the thing that in this world attracts you the most, your hobby, your love, whatever it is, the most important thing for you. And to think of that, that's an expression of God, whatever that thing is. But it's just such a tiny portion of what God is. And all of that excitement, all of that thrill, all of that exploration that you go through with whatever your greatest love is in this world. And God is all of that and much, much more. And then you think, why am I wasting my time on these trinkets when I have real gems inside of me? Now, just because it doesn't come in a day, just because we don't cut our addiction to this world in a moment, does not mean that it is not real and that there is not something inside of you that is beckoning to you to awaken, and that we must listen to this, because the world will prove itself time and time again that we will be hurt by this world, that this world will disappoint us, and in the end everything is taken away from us. How much better it is to offer it up at God's feet and let Him decide. Let Him decide. There's a great Sikh master, and he did a very unusual thing. He was working for the army at the time, and with his guru, he would send him his entire check when he got it. Now, this man had a family to support. He'd send him his entire check. And then whatever his guru gave back to him, he would find the means to live on it. That's quite something, isn't it? I don't want anybody to do that, so don't. But you think about what faith there is in that, what surrender there is in that. And so you give yourself to God that way. You give Him everything. And as Mother says here, when you give God everything, He gives you everything in return. Now, it's not that God is ever withholding from us, but there is a reciprocity that is set up, that as I give, so shall I receive. And you'll notice, and it makes sense from a worldly standpoint to reverse that. As I receive, so shall I give. Doesn't that make more sense? How can I give anything if I haven't received something? But the truth is, we're always receiving. But it's our tenacity to hold on to what we have. It's our attachment. And it can be an attachment to a thing. It can be attachment to a person. It can be an attachment to an idea. And that God will ask us for it all. Not that He needs anything, but that He knows what the principle is. And as I give, so shall I receive. As I give to God's feet, then I open myself to receive all that He wishes to give to me. And that means even giving up the idea of what that's supposed to look like. I love the story that's in the journal that Mother quotes from Sri Yukteswar, of the man who was trying to gain spiritual mastery and wanted to become a spiritually realized being. However, he had a material desire mixed in with his desire for God. And the idea, and it's not an unusual one, that he's making a bargain that as he gives everything to God, there's this wish-fulfilling tree that will give to him whatever it is that he wishes for. So he's got that in the back of his mind. And people will do that. They'll go to God and they'll think, if I give everything to God, then God will give me all the abundance that I want, all the good health that I want. Now, it's true that we set up the right conditions for us to get the maximum amount of everything. But it's all dictated by what is God's will for us at a particular time. But this man wanted it both. He wanted the spiritual life and he wanted the material life. And the material life began to loom bigger. And finally, he accomplished what was in the back of his mind. It came to the front of his mind, and he got the wish-fulfilling tree. And now he could create anything he wanted. So, of course, he wanted a big palace, and he wanted servants, and he wanted the grounds. And then he thought, well, I have all of these things. Somebody could take them away from me, so I need an army. So he created an army and guards, and they were all in. So he lays himself down to sleep, and he's at a back end of the house where no guards were, and he wanted that peace and quiet. And suddenly he had the thought in his mind, you know, a tiger could jump in through the window and carry me off and kill me and eat me. And there's no guards here to protect me. And no sooner than he had thought that, than a tiger jumped in because he still had the wish-fulfilling tree. And you see how it goes. That's what our desire does for us. And it's always tainted. It always will be. So when we give ourselves over to God, we say, God, you know what is best for me. You know what is best for me. And then we take whatever he gives to us. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't have a desire for a better life, or a better life for those who are around us. Because that's God creating inside of you as well. But you feel content, you feel happy with what he gives you in this moment, because it is perfect for you. It is like the man who lived in a small village, and he had a wife and he had some sons. And it seemed that no matter whatever God or whatever happened in his life, he said, God's will be done. And perhaps this is common between husbands and wives. This got a little irritating to the wife. She didn't always like the kind of things that happen, and was God really orchestrating all of that? And so it happened that their milk cow died, and he said, God's will be done. And one thing after another, they didn't have any firewood, they didn't have any animals, they didn't have anything at all. And she is so upset with him. And then a king, the ruler of that area, came through. And people were hiding in their huts, but the soldiers would come in and they'd grab any eligible boys or men for the army and then draft them right there and then. And they were be taken off to war. And so this family was sitting in their hut, and they didn't have any firewood, so there was no fire. They didn't have any cows, so there was no cow out in front. There wasn't any dog. There wasn't anything at all. So when the soldiers and the king came up, they assumed that the hut was deserted. And they didn't go inside to see, and so they passed it by. And then the wife saw what wisdom there was and what her husband had been saying, that their sons had been saved because of everything that had been taken away from them. So because we see things as a snapshot, we don't see things from the wide-angle lens of what has gone on before and what will go on afterwards. We just see things in the moment. And if something's taken away from us, if there's some difficulty, then we just think, God is being so mean to me. And we don't see the whole picture, you see. We don't see how it's fitting in to a much larger and a much wiser plan than what we could have ever dictated for ourselves. So we surrender what we have and all that we have at the feet of God. Take me, Lord. Do with me as you will. And for some of us, that would conjure up a little bit of anxiety. I'm not sure that God's really wanting what's best for me. That's the doubt that's underneath. And yet He absolutely is. That is our faith. That is our trust. That we trust God is orchestrating everything perfectly for us. And we accept with that calm equanimity, like that great, great lake before the waterfall. We look at life from that standpoint. And you know, when that lake is so placid and so still, it naturally reflects everything that is above it, the mountains, the stars, the sun, the moon. It all gets reflected in that lake. If it's all choppy with anxiety and worries, and then all you see is the choppiness of the water. You don't see those grand things that are above. It's not that they don't exist. You just simply don't see it. But you get to that calm equanimity, and everything above begins to reflect in that calm, flat state of the mind, what Papa called the static state. But we shouldn't think static as in no life. It's all life, all intelligence, everything that's of God is in that still state. So let us strive. Let us set aside that time. Let us go deeper, deeper, so that we may soar higher and know that infinite presence inside of us. Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. Give me love, pure love for Thee.
Give me Thy bliss, Thy joy, Thy light.
Make me mine forevermore. Such overwhelming bliss and love that God let us have this time together. Yesterday afternoon I wasn't sure, but made it all possible.